the impact of climate plus capitalism plus all these other forms of global governance, they're all coming together to create a very different truth and a very different reality to the one that's presented in the West.
Kind of the point of this podcast, right, is that there is an infinity of ways to think about climate change. But actually, if you turn on the telly here in the UK, you generally only get a couple of them. And there will be stories either where climate change is like this scientific phenomenon and a scientist comes on and tells you some stuff, or maybe a story about how climate change is affecting things. And those things might be stuff like it's going to make loads of people in countries like Pakistan come over here to the UK and steal all our stuff. Right? And I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not massively, because actually we do get only a limited amount of stories that make sense in our cultural context, knowledge that fits into the way that we kind of see the world. We may not like it, and we definitely don't always recognize it, but we do. And here in the UK, that's all because of our kind of history and the way our society works. And a lot of that history is a colonial one of exploitation, of taking. And this stuff absolutely fascinates me, and it's particularly fascinating, and this is where this podcast comes in, because it can be really hard to see and think your way out of if you're right in the middle of it. So on this episode of Your Brain on Climate, we're going to be looking at this thing called decolonization. Now, that's a word I can't always say, got too many syllables in it, but what it's talking about is Britain has, and other countries have, spent an awful lot of its history nicking stuff from other parts of the world, oppressing people, and kind of having this idea that we are great and we are in charge. And that idea dies hard, right? We've just had a coronation, and all of the stuff about kind of empire and Britain's power kind of drips through that, and it drips through our national story in ways that we don't even really understand, but it affects our framing and our understanding, certainly my understanding, of what climate change even is, kind of what I think to be good knowledge, good solution, and what I don't. So it's a story, but it's also a mindset. It's about going, there are an infinity of ways to think about climate change. There are very different stories, very different lived realities of what climate change even is. I'm not talking about climate denier type lived realities, although they obviously exist, but I'm talking about people who live with this stuff now, for whom their understanding of it, even the way they even think about what should be done and whose fault it is, can be quite radically different. And if we want to understand how our brains are thinking about the world, we kind of need to go, well, what are the other stories here? What's missing? So we're going to have a chat all about that. So joining me on this episode is the wonderful Dr. Aisha Siddiqui from Cambridge University. We're going to talk about a lot of this stuff, but this is such a lovely kind of accessible chat. I know some of this stuff can feel a bit intimidating. You know, it's got some long words in it, not in this podcast. We try not to use long words. It's not intimidating at all. It's actually really kind of liberating just to kind of go, hey, hang on a minute. The story that I've got is partial at best and, you know, laden with all of these ideas about the world, which everyone has, right? But understanding your own story and where it comes from, and then having someone really patiently and kindly explain to you all of the other stories and why it matters that we challenge that, and the deep problems that having just one kind of colonial story can have, is really, really cool. I really loved it. I strongly recommend this chat. You've got this far, stick around for the chat. It'll be great. As always, if you hear this noise, it denotes wisdom, of which Aisha has plenty. And I will put a little note in the show notes so you can find out more about the thing you have just heard. Thank you, as always, to everyone who sponsors me on Patreon. That pays for the costs for me to pay my guests to come on the show, which is really important to me. You know, I think I want to make sure people have the time and energy to come and tell me their interesting thoughts. So thank you so much. You can join them at www.patreon.com/yourbrainonclimate. If you like this show and you like what I'm doing, please chuck in a couple of quid a month. We can keep this show on the road and keep having interesting brain-type chat. Also, I'm on the Twitter, or X, or whatever it's called now, at BrainClimate. May or may not do a Threads. Probably need to do more social media stuff. Check out what I'm doing. And if you like what I'm doing, please, please, please go and give it a review on iTunes, whatever it's called now, got so old, and spread the word, tell people about it. It really makes a difference. Right, on with it. So, first thing in this chat was where Aisha was currently sat, Pakistan, where she was dialing in to the call, where as soon as I think of the two things, Pakistan and climate change, I can't help but think of the ludicrous temperatures that were there, I think it was last year, and what that meant and what it means and what that story about climate change really is. So I asked her about that.
You're brave. It's both hot and humid. So the hot part has been enjoyable coming from wet and rainy Cambridge. The humid and feeling really sticky and sweaty all the time, less so, I think.
Because it isn't Pakistan where they've had some, over the last few years, just properly ridiculous temperatures, like off the scale yes. kind of hot?
That is correct, yes. Last year was the extreme heat wave, which where temperatures recorded in the hottest parts of Pakistan appear to be higher than what the human body is able to function in. So they do a light bulb test where they check whether the human body can manage that degree of temperatures. And last kind of May, June, large parts of Pakistan, the temperatures were higher than what the human body can handle. So we are looking at extreme heat.
Which is bad news, right? Like, if that is the norm, then we are talking yes. about, well, what are we talking about?
I think it's difficult to hypothesize. And I always kind of steer clear of saying things like, oh, you know, large swaths of people are going to move here or move there, because I think that really feeds into a very alarmist kind of rhetoric. And so I kind of don't want to suggest that suddenly millions of people will be moving here and moving there. But I think what's more worrying is that immediately in the right now, instead of worrying too much about the future, right now, people are living in very, very dire, difficult situations. This is the only life they know and the only home they know. And instead of us worrying too much in Western societies about, oh gosh, what if these millions of poor people choose to come here, we should really just think about how unbelievably difficult lives currently are in all of these places where people have no choice but to live, and to live in very dehydrated, poor conditions. In Pakistan and places like Pakistan, we know electricity shortages are a big problem as well. So often when they're dealing with 50 degrees centigrade outside, they have no access to, let alone air conditioning, even things like fan or any other cooling device inside. So really very, very challenging conditions. And we should just kind of think more about ways in which we can take not just mini steps, but also more macro steps with regards to fossil fuel consumption and ways in which we try and shift a system which is so hell-bent on exploitation of more and more and more materials and consumerism.
Down with this sort of thing.
Careful now.
Down with this sort of thing.
Right, okay. Smashing the system we're going to do in a minute. But before we smash the system, before we smash any systems, let's take a step back. And actually, what you were just saying there is a really good example of why I was so keen to get you on. I heard you talk at a work thing I was at, and I was like, yes, I want to talk about that. Because over here, I'm in London, and you're in the UK a lot of the time, and you'll be very familiar with this sort of story that climate change might be a problem one day. Or, you know, for us in the UK, it's like, it's a thing you should care about, even though it doesn't affect us very much. But what you've just described there is, no, look, shut up, because for millions and millions of people around the world, This is here right now, and this isn't some hypothetical reality. This is here right now. And it sort of gets to the bottom of the fact that the story of climate change that probably on this podcast I've talked about quite a lot, and I think in the UK we talk about quite a lot, is not the only story of climate change that there is, right? And because it's a kind of Western, fairly white, fairly elitist, middle-classy sort of conversation. But there's loads of other ones. So that's my way of preamble, a way of talking about decolonializing, and decolonializing as a thing. And I wonder if you could just say a bit about, sort of picking up what I just said really, but like what is the problem with the story that here in the UK we kind of have about the world in general?
I mean, there are so many ways to tackle that, but let me kind of try and give a more focused, limited answer to just one or two points, right? So,
I always do this to people. I always say, like, if you could answer 25 things all at the same time, that'd be superb. So, quite right.
And also, yeah. You're speaking to a post-colonial scholar. I mean, I teach 20 lectures on exactly what you've highlighted there, but I think it is really important. So I think to kind of highlight that this, we need to challenge like hegemonic narratives, right? There isn't just a single story. There isn't just one narrative. There are multiple truths out there, and of course, living in the West, where the power and the privilege has been for the last however many hundreds of years, we've gotten used to thinking that our narrative or our reality or our truth is the one universal truth, right? But it is about trying to break this idea of universality. Nothing really is universal. People and structures in power determine what universality is. And so being really aware of the fact that on climate change, as on various other topics, there isn't one truth, you know. There isn't this idea that also, like you've said, that one day in the foreseeable future the climate is going to impact us. For the global majority, I think you just repeated what I said when I said millions of people, actually not millions of people, billions of people. Of the 7 billion people in this world, more people live in the global south. So actually for billions of people, there is a reality where they're dealing with all these kinds of extreme weather events and which are kind of interacting with ways of living with a capitalist system, which isn't necessarily the way that their societies were structured pre-European colonialism. And so the impact of climate plus capitalism plus all these other forms of global governance, they're all coming together to create a very different truth and a very different reality to the one that's presented in the West. And I think in some ways what kind of decolonization is trying to do is to bring to the fore that there isn't one story, there isn't one idea, there isn't one universal truth, they're multiple, and that a lot of what we recognize as truths are built on the backs of particular kinds of oppression that has been the way that the world has operated since European colonialism first reached the Americas. And so we have to, in some ways, there is a much bigger onus on us as the places where the narrative presented is the dominant narrative, to really, really go out and seek other ways of other pieces of news, other information, question, well, if this is the narrative we're getting, then what is the narrative that's missing, and where is that coming from? And so I think maybe if we talk about everyday decolonization? How do we decolonize every day in our lives, in our homes? I think a good start would be to question and to challenge the narratives that are presented to us and to seek what's missing. Why is this narrative being presented and not a different one?
So what is, let's take this bit by bit, because I think this might sort of warrant some unpicking. First of all, I guess, like, what's the story, what is the dominant story, let's say, about climate change that you think in the West is generally held? So what is the colonialized story?
So I think that the dominant narrative, I mean, there's so many. Again, I'm going to try and limit this to just a few that we can, a couple, let's say, that I might be able to unpick, right? So one is when we were speaking just a minute ago about what does extreme heat mean for people. I think that there is a lot of conversation about movement of people, climate migration or climate refugees or whatever, because islands are sinking or sea levels are rising or, extreme weather events are taking place, and that these, again, large numbers of people are going to come into more industrialized, whatever, westernized parts of the world, and that this is a real kind of quote-unquote security threat for us. Now, admittedly, there is a slightly, right-wing tinge on this. Perhaps The Guardian is reporting this slightly more sensibly. But on the whole, if we talk about the idea that climate change is going to result in large masses of land becoming uninhabitable, then the story inevitably becomes becomes one of large-scale migration to the global north. So we encounter this in lots of different ways. We see images of islands that are sinking, or the last remaining polar bear on a glacier, because that, or the iceberg, because the iceberg is no longer going to be there, and all the ways in which land is becoming uninhabitable. And I kind of want to push back against that story and suggest that all the research that we've done on things like movement because of climate change, or movement because of hazards like typhoons, floods, etc., they all suggest, firstly, that when a hazard settles, in almost all cases, people want to go back home. They don't want to use that as an excuse to migrate to Europe. Like, that's what they're asking. They want to go home. Secondly, when things actually become too challenging to go home, they're much more likely to move to other parts of the same country. They're, again, not likely to think of traveling long distances. If that isn't possible, they're more likely to settle in neighboring countries or locations or whatever. So south to south migration, right? Like Lebanon, for example, is the country with the largest amount of non-citizen residents because of the Syrian war, the Palestinian refugees, etc. So actually, people moving from countries in the global south to neighboring countries within the global south, where they have more cultural links, more language links, etc., is, again, far more common. So the next time, maybe this is a kind of direct example that I can give of a hegemonic narrative or a hegemonic story. The next time someone who's listening to us on this podcast comes across terms like climate migration, climate refugees, the need for having stringent kind of border controls around things like this, really kind of pushing back against those narratives, questioning those narratives, asking more around, what is the evidence to suggest that this is going to happen? Because all of the research shows it's just a very, very kind of unlikely scenario to take place.
A It's fascinating, isn't it? Because underneath that sits some really deeply held cultural ideas. And I'm talking here from the UK, you know, where I grew up, and, you know, I kind of know the stories and the narratives here, right? And some really deeply held stories about people from other countries coming here to take what we have, right? And these kind of, and that comes down, that's a long held thing for a country like the UK, which, you know, sees itself and at one point was richer than a lot of places. It's really deep, right? And so is what you're saying, that the reason that those sort of stories have such currency, and when we think climate change, we think, oh, that's going to make loads of foreigners come over here. It's because actually it's tapping into these ideas that themselves go way back to kind of the history of what the UK has done in the world and where we've been for the last 500 years or more.
Yes. And actually, if I'm honest, I often think this because... And in some ways, perhaps this entire conversation that we're having is somewhere, it sits somewhere in between my own kind of personal views and experience and my academic interests. So speaking now less as an academic and more as an individual who moved to the UK when I was in my 20s, one of the first things that occurred to me was that the UK as a country, as a society, and perhaps England even more so than places like Scotland, hasn't really engaged with decolonizing its own society, right? So we still think it's acceptable to have large cultural ideas or institutions like the Imperial War Museum. Like, this is an acceptable thing in 2022 to have, you know, these massive monuments, institutions, structures that celebrate imperialism and that celebrate Britain's imperial might. And look how we saved the world, and this really masculine ideas of it's a really, and of course, admittedly, I don't mean to say everyone in a large country of 60 million people feels this way, but that it's culturally still acceptable to have things called imperial, to have institutions celebrating those forms of imperialism, to have empire very much running through kind of central places, societies, etc.
Well, we love it though, don't we? I mean, look, we've just had over here like a new king after the death of an old queen, and I mostly avoided it all because I can't really be doing with all that hoo-ha. But you, like, it was everywhere. Like, even if not directly, kind of, you know, the king wasn't being serenaded by loads of, you know, people saying how brilliant empire was, except he kind of was. That kind of this story, what, you know, that story of why a lot of people in Britain love the royalty is kind of connected, I think, to a deeper idea about this fondness for, when, you know, this imperial past and this romantic idea of all of that, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that for the most part, there is a real failing, even within the public education system, within the curriculum and the syllabus in schools, because there's only one story, again, of empire that is told, or one story of Britain saving the world in the Second World War, or whatever that's told. But the genocide, the erasure of history, the erasure of knowledge systems, the genocidal violence that empire unleashed upon millions of people around the world, that's not part of what children are learning in schools, right? So that critical thinking, most people didn't. And so that critical thinking around these issues, that doesn't develop. So you can't suddenly expect someone in later on in their lives to be all kind of radical and revolutionary and questioning why is Charles using that coronation. Was ridiculously expensive as well, all taxpayers' money. 1960s. So they aren't suddenly going to, in their 60s, be questioning why is this coronation using all of our taxpayers' money in the middle of a cost of living crisis, right? It has to be a kind of way of thinking, making the brain challenge particular ideas that have been fed and taught to us from the time we were very young, and Britain just isn't there. It's not something that it's prioritizing at all.
God save the king!
God save the king!
And it doesn't mean, I think this is where we can start to like piss people off, right? It doesn't mean, and you I hardly need to tell you, that some of this stuff can be quite inflammatory for a certain type of person who quite likes, thank you very much, the idea of Britain being, you know, in some way a powerful, influential nation and is, you know, not necessarily ashamed of its past. It doesn't mean you hate Britain to take a step back and go, what is this story that we're kind of unquestioningly told? Right? Like, surely there's room to still be a really, to love loads of stuff about Britain and the country that we're in. And obviously, again, this is a very UK kind of aspect. Help me with this.
In my view, I think if I'm, if I've kind of tried to question and think about some of these things, I think, firstly, this kind of blinding nationalism or patriotism that doesn't question anything, that doesn't challenge anything, I'm not convinced that that's love. I think when you feel particular kinds of feelings, those feelings have to come with ideas of, you know, this needs to be done better. And we're kind of falling behind on this, and so I think, I don't know if I would use the word love, but I think I would definitely use the word or try and indicate to people that this is not about trying to get anyone to hate or to despise the UK, but it is definitely about questioning and being aware and being honest, really. I don't know, Dave, is this something that's acceptable for your audience or not? But I think we have to be really honest, right? Could Britain have been and be the kind of you know, wealthy or rich nation that it is today had it not been built on the backs of the people who were involved in the kind of genocidal or were the subject of or were oppressed through the kind of genocidal violence, the famines that the imperial state unleashed? I mean, all of this is connected. We can't just pretend like what happens there happens there, and that there's no connection to the lives we're living today, right? So I think to be informed is a sign of respect for people within the country. Do you really want to love a quote unquote love a country, or do you want to have a connection to its people, to its living, breathing, populace? I don't know what's more important. To me personally, I'm not sure buildings and monuments are as important as lives.
Your brain. On climate.
Right, so at this point, the internet went down and I had to smack it with a hammer until it came back on again. Aisha and I got talking again, everything was fine. So I thought I'd pick it up by asking Aisha about research. colonial mindsets, colonial ways of thinking about the world will generate certain research questions, and the money will flow to those research questions. And that seems like it's only going to reinforce only finding out certain types of question and only coming up with certain types of answer, right?
It begins to get really, really problematic when we're talking about things taking place, social processes, issues taking place in the global south, in communities, countries, etc., in the global south. But we're not really asking people in the global south about these things. So there have been very active campaigns by students in universities to say, we don't want our reading lists to have primarily 99% white male middle-aged men authors. Yeah. We need more diversity in the curriculum, in the reading list, because with the voices of BAME scholars, with the voices of scholars based within the global south, we begin to then hear more of these challenging perspectives, perspectives that are moving beyond a particular rationality or ideas that were presented to people in, during Enlightenment in the 17th, 18th centuries, that slowly through particular forms of colonialism took over the world, right? So even knowledge is colonized in some ways, and we need to be able to bring research, bring universities, bring academic institutions to a place where that perspective, the perspective that comes from an Enlightenment style rational knowledge, isn't considered the priority, isn't considered superior to all other scholarship and all other research and knowledge that is being produced.
I mean, you're not talking about chucking out climate science, right?
No, absolutely not. We're talking about not thinking of science as only being what is produced through climate models. Why can science not be, centuries of lived experience with particular kinds of climate conditions? Why can science not be a different way of knowing, not in a lab, but outdoors, living amidst the particular kinds of flora and fauna being studied, right? Why does science only have to be what particular institutions and structures of power say it is?
Yeah, and I suppose this is getting to the heart of the problem, isn't it? Or the heart of the issue, because there's, if I think about how I understand climate change and the framing that I often refer to, it's a kind of scientific one, first and foremost, right? Mm. And you'll often hear climate talked about on the BBC or something as like, now we're going to talk about climate change and we're going to get a climate scientist to come and talk to you about it. And yes, they will talk about degrees and emissions and stuff that matters and is important, right? But yes, that is seen in a lot of cases as being the beginning and end of the matter. There is a sort of mathematical scientific process being modeled here, and therefore that somehow should tell us what to do about it, or tell us why we should care about it, or tell us what it means in practice. But it isn't like that, because actually climate isn't just a scientific thing, it's an everything thing, right? And it's already affecting loads of people's lives already. So it does point to why we need these other ways of understanding the problem, but it could be really hard to kind of smack your brain out of thinking about climate a particular way, I think.
Yes, and I think that this is actually something that increasingly is being talked about in you know, places like universities and research based institutions, but perhaps isn't making its way into the public domain as well as much. When the public thinks about climate science, they think about a particular kind of modeler who's modeling climate scenarios, etc. But in a lot of discussions around the IPCC, which is the big intergovernmental panel that produces, through a collaboration of lots of scientists, these reports that's documenting changes because of climate change, there is sections, and there are people who are no longer just the modelers and the people who work on hydrometeorology or climatology or whatever, but you also now have social scientists and people who study society and people's engagement with the environment and all of that. So that kind of move of, this isn't just one way of, or this can't just be one branch of knowledge that has complete ownership of the climate change narrative. We need the other forms of scholarship involved as well. That's beginning, but I think that there is a longer way to go, and more arts and humanities understandings of climate change also need to be included, and just a real decolonizing of and taking away the power of just a very rational scientific model around climate change and the use of just that language around climate change.
Yeah, because we're not saying chuck out the science, chuck out the, quote, scientific evidence. It's what other understandings can this bring? Yes?
Yes, and also, what does science mean? Is science just what the climatologists and hydrometeorologists are doing? Or, like I said, can science also be, long-term lived experience or long-term understanding or a different way of knowing, but also in knowing in a lot of depth? Can that not be science?
So let's, before we sort of wrap this up, let's just talk. We talked about this at the start, and let's come back to it now. What can we all do? Because most of us are not in charge of curricula at universities or things like that. So what can I start to do the next time I am watching a story about climate change on the news, or thinking about it, or talking to someone about it? What's a good thing to do to try to get my brain out of the stuff that it tends to think about and the ideas it tends to think about, a lot of which are colonially implanted in, say, my head?
So I would be tempted to say that a good starting point is very much around, and we've spent quite a lot of time today talking about this, is around not accepting the dominant narratives that we are being hit with, right? So a lot of the work after or a lot of the conversation after Roads Must Fall or Black Lives Matters or these kinds of movements, a lot of the conversation has been around do the work. So this is work. Anyone who's serious, who feels, there is a genuine problem or issue, or however we want to frame it euphemistically, around white privilege, around centuries of one part of the world being in control, etc. Anyone who recognizes these as significant blinkers that they might have on. They need to think that those apply to all aspects of their lives, including to an issue as big and as kind of existential in some ways as climate change. So it is hard work. We have to do the work to not just accept the first narrative that is being put forward, to read other perspectives, to go back to the name of the author and where they're coming from, if they're your standard middle class white researcher or writer in a mainstream London university, then perhaps
probably called Dave.
Yes, that's a good point. Probably called Dave or in
Dave's had a problem. I've often thought Dave's needs to be smashed.
No, yeah. Actually, there is academic research on the Matthew effect, which is the research has shown, and there are a number of different studies showing how if your name is Matthew, your work is much more likely to be cited and to be in the reading lists and things like that. So I think we all need to make space for people who are not called Matthew to also be able to take this space.
Aisha, thank you so much for coming on Your Brain on Climate. Is there any way that people can find out more about your work or find some good reading lists or anything you would like to point people to follow you or to find out more about this really important stuff?
Yes, you can find me on the Cambridge University website. If you write my name, Aisha Siddiqui, University of Cambridge, arrive at my website. All the stuff that I've published is available there. I'm also on Twitter, LinkedIn, those kinds of social media outlets, and I'm always very happy to speak more about decolonizing. So feel free to hit me up.
Wonderful stuff. Thank you so much, Aisha, for coming on and doing that. I loved that chat. I love that thing of prizing open the little can inside which your view of the world sits, asking yourself where it comes from, asking yourself what other story might be out there, challenging yourself to listen to that story, and it is often challenging, and recognizing that the things your brain thinks about the world are kind of laid on top of like centuries of ideas and stories and power and all of these things. We've all got it, not just in, the West. Everyone has that set of biases and set of stories about the world. And just cracking into that a bit and recognizing there are an infinity of other ways of thinking about a problem, I find it profoundly liberating and exciting. And it feels like it offers, it's a better way of approaching something like climate change, which is just so vast and tentacular, if I can get all squiddy about things for a minute. If you liked that and you like what I do, it needs Dosh to continue. That Dosh can be provided at patreon.com/yourbrainonclimate. I know every podcast in the world asks you for a Patreon, but I'm little and they are big, and often the people that ask you for money are also taking loads of adverts, which I'm not, and they have Acast and Spotify's behind them. Support independent podcasting. If you like what I do, you've got to pay for it. You don't have to pay for it. It'd be nice if you paid for it. www.patreon.com/yourbrainonclimate. Right, that's it. I am off. I'm off to think very hard about what I have done, culturally speaking, over the last 300 years. And I hope you do too. And if that's not a big enough thought, I shall see you next time for more Your Brain on Climate. Okay, bye.